are happy to have with us Congressman Luis Gutierrez this hour. He is an 11-term Democratic congressman from Chicago and the author of Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. And he's coming to Madison for a Wisconsin Book Festival event tomorrow. More on that later. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about comprehensive immigration reform and other issues that Congressman Gutierrez, who was a key player in the passage of the DREAM Act, is still dreaming about. And we will welcome your questions and your views for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Congressman Gutierrez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Before we get to your story, let me get to your reaction to the story of the day. Day three of the partial government shutdown over the House Republicans' desire to delay the Affordable Care Act. The president met with congressional leaders last night at the White House, and no progress was made. There appears to be no end in sight. What's going to happen here?
I don't think anyone knows. I just came up from the house gym getting ready for my day. And I have to tell you that I talked to both Republican and Democratic colleagues, and the best they can tell me is that we're going to end our schedule today between 2 and 3 o'clock. And that means I can go home, see my wife and my daughter and my grandson for the evening, and probably have to come back again here tomorrow morning. I'm lucky in that sense. But nobody really knows. No one knows. I talk to people, and I have many good friends in the Republican caucus who share with me. I will share with you that I see a great degree of frustration, even among my Republican colleagues. I think the problem with the institution of Congress is that it is very hard to break out of your caucus. There really is a group mentality. And if you distance yourself or depart from the norm that is set by the leadership, whether it's Republican or Democrat, and many of them, so this is a very bipartisan comment, you tend to stand out alone. And it's a very, sometimes it's a dangerous place. It's simply a lonely place, too. So I see more and more frustration, and hopefully that will bubble up to the point where we're going to get a vote. So that we can just have people should understand that what we're talking about is simply allowing the government to pay its bill for the next, 7 or 8 weeks now, and then come up to a budget. And let's be clear, the president's budget, $1.2 trillion. The Democrats have agreed to, I think, run $980 billion budget. Ryan's budget was right around $970 billion. So we're much closer to the Ryan budget than we are to the Democratic budget by a long shot. So I don't know why they just won't accept yes for an answer. Well, I do know, because the one Republican member of Congress that voted for the Affordable Care Act, the Republicans in the next primary defeated him. They do not want affordable care, health care for our people. And when one of them stands out, we've seen what's happened.
So do you think that this Congress, as partisan as it is, will ever get around to passing comprehensive immigration reform, which I know is very important to you?
Yeah, well, there's the issue where it's a little different. So let's just very quickly. So New York Times, Wall Street Journal, their editorial boards look at things from very different perspectives, right? Yet, it's almost like plagiarism, right, reading what they suggest we do about immigration and encouraging Congress to act. AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Congress fight. I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce fight every day on Capitol Hill. They send down their lobbyists and spend millions of dollars support. They agree. They have a common position on immigration. Think about the union organized for farm workers. Cesar Chavez organized it over 40 years ago. The United Farm Workers has mimicked a major agreement with the major growers across this country, whether they're in Wisconsin or California or Florida, anywhere in this country. I think that demonstrates, and if you look at Democrats and Republicans in terms of Clinton or former President Bush, you see the kind of music it exists. In the Senate, you got a McCain who kind of, well, as I write in my book, first we wrote comprehensive immigration reform, then he walked away, and then he came back to be such a fine soldier in getting it through the Senate. The only place, it seems to me, where we can't set aside our differences and where people can't compromise and reach a solution is in the House of Representatives. But even here, Paul Ryan, congressman, vice presidential candidate, nominee and candidate for the Republican Party, he and I have sat down. He came to Chicago. I invited him to the City Club. He came out to the neighborhood immigrant community. He was well received. He is for comprehensive immigration reform. And this week alone, the Weekly Standard wrote an article in which they identified 84 Republican members of the House of Representatives that would vote for legalizing 11 million undocumented workers in this country. So I think there is a wonderful opportunity. You don't see that on the, you don't see that kind of unity on the fiscal cliff. You don't see it on the budget. You don't see it on guns. You don't see it on women's reproductive rights. It is the one issue where you do see unity. So I am still very hopeful.
So why do we see the unity on this issue and not the others?
I think because it is one that has percolated up, right? It is one that we've fought through the election. There was actually a referendum on this. If you think of November 6, 2012, right? I mean, everybody understood. It was like all of the talking heads and pundits that evening woke up and were said, wow, 12, 13 million Latinos voted. And it looks like they're going to be critical, essential, fundamental to the election of the next president of the United States. Almost an astonishment that we even existed as a political entity and community in the United States. That's the way I remember election night. And as they saw one state after another, whether it was Colorado or Nevada or Florida, you see the critical. I think Republicans have seen that too. John McCain said it best. He used one word when he was asked, why now for comprehensive immigration reform? And he said, politics. Look, there are different numbers, but they range around 60,000. That's a number everyone can agree. 60,000 Latinos reach the age of 18 every month. 60,000. 2 million more Latinos voted in 2008 than 2004. 2 million more voted in 2012 than in 2008. You see the increasing number and their influence. And let's face it, I mean, in Illinois, it was well over 80% of the Latinos voted for Barack Obama. Nationally, it was 74%. The Republican Party will become a party of geographically, of provinces, of localities, and of states. It will never be a national party again because there is this growing, and it's not only Latinos, it's immigrants. Asians voted over 70%, and they are the fastest growing population in the United States. When you look at immigrants coming to this country, the majority of them today are coming.
It's a President Obama to put this high on the agenda, that your complaints irritated him, that he asked you one time to get off his back?
Let me. So when I wrote the book, I decided that many people don't really get, will never get a bird's eye view, a first-hand view of what it's like to be in a negotiation with your president, what it's like to have to challenge your own president, to be a member of Congress in your own caucus, and to be looked at. I mean, many of my colleagues said, Luis, if you'd simply stop complaining, maybe we'd move forward. Luis, you're going to hurt Barack Obama's elections for re-election. And I kept responding to them. My job was to come here to get that was my promise and my commitment. And I think that should be our promise and our commitment, first to people and public policy, and second to our party. And I think if Republicans and Democrats did more of that, there would be much more success in the Congress. So it was difficult. And he did tell me to get off his back. But you know what? It is what is necessary and critical. But I want your readers to know that we also write about a very early meeting with Barack Obama in which he was just senator, just, right? How can you say that so easily when he's a two-term member of, president of the United States? Look, I have supported him in 2008 when no other member of the Hispanic Congressional Caucus was with Barack Obama. They were all with Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton was sweeping the Latino vote. She may not have won the nomination, but she swept the Latino vote in New York and in Florida, in Illinois and in Texas and in California. She crushed Barack Obama. I stood with him. We had a conversation. He knew. I didn't ask him to give a keynote speech at the Democratic convention. I didn't ask him for an ambassadorship. I didn't sit down there and negotiate something for myself. I didn't use politics. I said, I want public policy commitment from you. He made that commitment. I thought it was important. He didn't only make it to me, George. He said during his campaign, first year of his presidency, he would sign a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And to be quite honest, I mean, the public can look back. We controlled. We had 60 votes in the Senate. We had 250 votes in the House of Representatives. And we had the presidency of the United States. And we did not act on this critical issue and commitment that he made. And so I did challenge him, but I also challenge Republicans every day. And I want to end with this on this point. I supported him in 2012 again. I went to Tampa to the Republican convention to speak to news outlets about why it was important to elect him. I traveled all across this country supporting his reelection. So, yes, I have criticized him, and, yes, at the same time, I've always stood up for his reelection. And, you know, I may have problems on this one fundamental issue and disagreements with my president on this one fundamental issue. But as I write in the book, there are 200 Republicans who would vote against sunlight if it was proposed by Barack Obama.
We are talking with Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He is an 11-term Democratic congressman from the 4th District in Illinois, Chicago, Illinois. He is the author of the book Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. He's going to be in Wisconsin tomorrow. He's going to be here as a part of the Wisconsin Book Festival, speaking at the Monona Terrace in Madison at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. More information on that and on his book on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. If you would like to talk to him about why he is still dreaming, or issues about immigration reform or other issues, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Congressman Luis Gutierrez, the first Latino to be elected to Congress from the Midwest. He is coming to Wisconsin tomorrow as a part of the Wisconsin Book Festival. He will be speaking about his book, Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. He'll be speaking at the Monona Terrace at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Well, before we take some calls, Congressman Gutierrez, tell us a little bit about that barrio. You grew up in Chicago in the 50s. Your parents moved here from Puerto Rico?
Yes. So, thank you. Well, look, I think my story is proof that you can't dream too big. And so I share the story of all the unexpected twists and turns of the son of a cab driver. My mom worked in a factory. We lived in a small apartment in the barrio in Chicago. And today I'm a guy negotiating immigration policy with Republicans and Democrats and leadership and with the President of the United States. And I wanted to tell the story of a person who can share a story of perseverance in his life, who started with very little and yet has been able to reach so much. So as I grew up, I wanted to share with people that, look, I remember growing up in that apartment, and, you know, when you reach, just before you reach puberty, that was around 11 years of age, they said, you're out. You've got to go to the closet now in the hallway. And that's where we're going to put a cot. And yet today, I'm in the Congress of the United States. I wanted to grow up living in Chicago, being born in 1953, Chicago is, yes, north of the Mason-Dixon line, but such a segregated city that I grew up in, where blacks lived in one part of town, whites lived in another, Latinos in another, and there was very clear dividing. And I tell stories about growing up. I looked at police officers, assembly, as people who simply always wanted to know where I was going, what I was doing, even though all I was doing and only place I was going were normal teenage things. And I relate how being always having to be harassed by the Chicago. I never thought of a Chicago police officer as somebody that would serve and protect. And growing up in a city like Chicago and the segregation, I wanted to relate. And, you know, how it is that my dad probably looked at the Democratic Convention of 68. I lived in Lincoln Park. And the riots of 69 after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And growing up in that Latino neighborhood and what it was like to go to public schools there. But then, when I was 15, my mom and dad, so I was always kind of an outsider in Chicago, right? Kind of think of, for those listeners of you, think of West Side Story, right?
Okay.
So that was the way Puerto Ricans on the island of Puerto Rico saw me when I arrived. When I was 15, my mom and dad decided they were going to return home. And home to them was the island of Puerto Rico. I tell the story about how they saved up their money and how it was always, my mom used to say in Spanish, "Esta no es mi tierra." This is not my land. Mm. She saw gangbangers on the corner or somebody, or we arrived home. It was almost a rite of passage almost in our neighborhood to one day arrive home and find your flour and your sugar and your rice strewn on the floor and every valuable of yours taken away. A common occurrence. And so when that would happen, she would say, "Esta no es mi tierra." When it would snow too much and she would have a hard time getting to work, she wanted to go home. And my dad wanted to go home. And they did. The problem was I was leaving the only home I ever knew. So I left from being an outsider in a segregated city and living in Puerto Rico. And you would think, wow, that's a good place for a brown-skinned kid to grow up, right? It should be a welcoming with lots of other Puerto Ricans since it's all that's there. So they went back to a small little town where everything was sugarcane and coffee, a rural area from a big city of Chicago. And now it was the Americanito, right? People called me gringo.
Yeah.
Again, I was the outsider. And I tried to weave into my story the sense of being an outsider there, being an outsider in Chicago, and seeing the outsiders of today, the immigrants of today, and trying to share with people that there really is a pretty natural relationship between my love, my vocation, my caring, the importance I give the immigrant community, and the life. And we try to weave that out. Now, I want to tell the readers also that I think a memoir should be about stories. It shouldn't be so much about the dates, right, and the hour, but about stories. And so we tell and we weave this into stories that are fun. I think that when you read a book, it should be fun. You should be able to laugh. And I think that even at some of the harshest moment in my life, I think I will bring forward laughter. The laughter that you can have because of many years since those very hard and painful moments have passed. So I want to share with people that, you know, picking coffee, the little gringo picking coffee faster than anyone else, except nobody told me I should only pick the red ones. So, yeah,
oh, no.
I picked my bushel quicker than anyone else, and I thought I was going to revolutionize agriculture and coffee in Puerto Rico until they told me, no, you pick only the red ones, Luis. My experience and my joy of life, I convey in the book. And then I grew up, obviously, I came back to Chicago, the rough and tumble politics. I remember one time I read the property taxes on the city council floor of one of the members of the city council. And he told me, you know, the first ward of the city of Chicago has always been allegedly the mob ward. And he said, then Alderman Rohde said, you know, Luis, shouldn't have read my property taxes. There's one thing the first ward always has. It has the Chicago River. I relate those stories. I relate the stories of coming to Congress and the Congress of the United States and the kind of, and being on 60 Minutes. On 60 Minutes and how I was the butt of jokes to the point where I had to challenge one of my colleagues to a fist fight. So
why were you the butt of jokes?
I want to bring you in. I want to bring you in. I want to share with you the experience and what it's like.
Well, how did you find your way into politics?
I found my way into politics first in Puerto Rico as a young man. When I went to Puerto Rico, everybody kind of rejected me because I want everybody to just think one moment, right? The perspective of Puerto Ricans on the island of Puerto Rico was what? Of their brothers and sisters that had gone to the mainland, right? I mean, they didn't have very much of a perspective on us. Their perspective was the same one that everyone else had seen on West Side Story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the Puerto Rican gang, we weren't the Jets, something modern. We were the Sharks, something to fear. We weren't the guys with the white gym shoes. We were the guys with the black gym shoes. We were the ones on welfare. And so that's, and especially when you go to a small town that is very, very structured socially and economically, you are an outcast. I couldn't speak the language. I grew up in a bilingual household, and I want to relate to people. This fear about, well, those Latinos just won't learn English. They'll never assimilate. Well, I think your listeners can hear me today, and I don't know what kind of accent I have, but I doubt that I have the accent of somebody that had difficulty assimilating into the United States of America and speaking the English language. My point is I tell the story of what it's like to live there. And so the people who reached out to me, interestingly and ironically enough, and I convey the story, are those who believe in Puerto Rican independence. They said, Luis, welcome from the exile. You're part of our diaspora, and welcome back. They were the most welcoming to me. They said things like, you know, you've been Puerto Rican since the moment you were conceived in your mother's womb. That really touched and affected me, especially being such an outsider. And I joined the Puerto Rican independence movement, and I relate the stories of the joy and my first beginnings. And then I kind of take, there's a real lull in my life in politics. I go into what I call Mork and Mindy stage. I don't know how many of you remember Crazy Robin Williams back in the 70s and early 80s with his program. And I say it's the Mork and Mindy because I used to watch the program every week. It's something I look forward to. I got married. I had a child. We bought a house. I mowed the lawn. I had a six-pack of beer on the weekends and played some dominoes with my friends, right? I look forward to the next marriage of a friend or someone's baptism. But my life was very, how would I say it, without political consequence in terms of my relationship between my own personal life and the lives of others. It was really about my family and my house. And that's very, very normal and I think very, very traditional. And so someone knocked on my door and said, we should support EPTN, Mr. Gutierrez. The Democratic Party in 1983, Harold Washington, African-American member of Congress, wins the nomination. They went on to write that it caused a Beirut on the lake. And Harold Washington won the nomination, and the Democratic Party, Dan Rostenkowski, and every Democratic leader in the city of Chicago, just about every white Democratic leader, decided they were going to now leave the Democratic Party. You can imagine Chicago leaving the Democratic Party. They were going to leave it for the next election and support a Republican. And I said to myself, I need to get involved. This is clearly a case of racism. This is clearly a case of bigotry, and I need to step up. And so I stopped watching the episodes of Morgan Mindy. Mm-hmm. I had fewer beers on weekends. I still mowed my lawn and kept my house in tip-top shape. But I also got involved in greater issues of my community. And so the election of Harold Washington, the first black mayor of the city of Chicago, changed and transformed my life. And I relate to you the firebombing of my house. Many people will listen to me today and they'll see me on Sunday morning programs, and they'll see me at my very best, and they'll say, oh, 11-term member of Congress, isn't he? I want to relate to you how that in the very beginning, there was a bomb that came through the living room of my house, how I had to take my daughter, and it's really tough, the politics of the city of Chicago. And so paving the way to Congress hasn't always been the easiest one.
Well, I'm going to come back to that that story of the firebombing, but we have a number of callers who want to talk to you. And Victor in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hello, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Congressman Gutierrez.
Good morning.
I have a couple of questions for you. One, do you think there should be an official language in the United States, preferably bilingual, or should it stay the same? And if it ever comes up again, there's three factions. There's Puerto Rico independence, statehood, or commonwealth. Which one would you support?
Thank you. Great question. Here's what I believe. I believe that English is the language of the United States and that it's unquestioned. Let me just state this for you. The cemetery for foreign languages ever in the history of humanity, the greatest cemetery is the United States. The Germans came and they buried Germans. The Italians came and they buried Italians. The Poles came and they buried. And as you can see, in order to get my grandson, Luisito, who I'm so proud of, we send him to Spanish immersion classes. And when I ask him and I say, hey, Luisito, would you like to practice a little Spanish? He always turns around and says, Grandpa, but I already did that in school. English is our language, number one. It isn't being threatened, so I don't know why we have to have this conversation unless you want to stoke fear in people, number one. In terms of Puerto Rico, look, I celebrate the 4th of July. I'm an American. I was born in this country. I've learned to celebrate. I learned to check the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And so I say Puerto Rico should just follow in that tradition and be a free, independent, sovereign nation. And I believe that at the same time, we should have a very close relationship. In other words, this isn't the 50s and the 60s, right? This is a new time in which we can be free and sovereign at the same time and have a very close and loving relationship with the United States.
Thanks for the call, Victor. Now we go to Gary in Merrill. Hello, Gary.
Yes, hello. Well, to your guest, we have had a comprehensive immigration policy. It's the law of the land since the 80s. We gave amnesty to 3 million Hispanics, and that was the law. It's still on the books. White Europeans, there's hundreds of thousands of them that have applied for citizenship. They've been waiting for decades. They're locked out. If they do come here, they've got passports, work visas, education visas. For some reason, we think that, I guess for racist reasons, we're going to coddle certain groups of people and let them stay here, and we discriminate against white Europeans.
So, Congressman Gutierrez, is amnesty being granted with comprehensive immigration reform this time around?
Yes. I think the caller refers to 1986, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, proposed and championed by none other than President Ronald Reagan. 3 million people legalized their status that were undocumented in 1986. But he says it was 3 million Hispanic. It wasn't. There were hundreds of thousands of Latinos and hundreds of thousands of Europeans and hundreds of thousands of Asians. Everybody that was undocumented had an opportunity. The fact is that today there are millions, I want to underscore that, millions of undocumented workers from Asia, from Europe, from Africa that are non-Hispanic. The fact is that we share a border with Mexico. And so we have more from Latin America, but that's a question of geography. But there are millions from all over the world. Look, there aren't people waiting in line for comprehensive immigration reform isn't stopping them. Our immigration system is stopping everybody. I want to say something. There are 11 million undocumented workers in the United States of America. We are not granting them amnesty. Let me make very, very clear, as a strong leading advocate for comprehensive immigration reform, I want them to become citizens of the United States so that they have all of the same responsibilities and all of the same obligations that I have in terms of defending this nation and maintaining this nation's strength, number one. Number two, I want to have comprehensive immigration reform so that, in the end, every job created in America, someone born in America, gets first crack at that job, gets first opportunity to take that job. And then when there isn't an American, and there won't be, because there are millions working the fields of America, picking our fruit and picking our vegetables and maintaining our agriculture, doing backbreaking work that no one in America wants to do. So there will always be opportunities for the newcomers, but that's comprehensive immigration reform. It's securing our border. But how do you have a secure border? I want to bring people here with visas. The gentleman speaks about people coming with. I want all of them to come. The fact is you can't come because the system is broken. So I'd rather you come with visas than with a smuggler because that allows you. Lastly, our economy. The Congressional Budget Office, clearly an independent nonpartisan, looked at the Senate proposal for comprehensive immigration reform and says, if you legalize 11 million people, you will create a surplus to the federal treasury of $175 billion in the first 10 years. And in the second 10 years, once they are fully integrated into our economy, it's $1 dollars to the good. So for the good of our economy and for the good, on the fairness issue, I will just say something. There are millions, millions of undocumented in this country whose husbands, wives, and children are either citizens or permanent residents of the United States and have petitioned for them but cannot because our system is broken. So I'm tired. I'm sorry. I'm tired of seeing family after family after family destroyed because we can't have and can't fix our immigration system. And I'm going to challenge America to be better. We questioned immigrants in the 1850s from Ireland and said, the dirty, filthy, ignorant Irish have come here to destroy our nation. They were wrong about them then, and they are wrong about the immigrants today.
You know, tomorrow, or I should say Saturday, is the National Day for Human Dignity and Respect, and Wisconsin is going to be joining a number of states around the country.
167 as we speak.
Really? All right. So, yeah, 167 events planned for Saturday across the country, including in Milwaukee, in Racine, in Kenosha, in Green Bay.
6 weeks ago, and it's coming. It's going so well. And I'm going to be at the one in Chicago.
Yeah, so what's the point of these rallies?
Okay, here's you know, Washington, D.C., this is the place of fact-checking, especially when it comes to politicians and things that we say. So here's what I've said. I said, for the first time in the last 20 years, a majority exists in the House of Representatives for comprehensive immigration reform. I said there are 40 to 45 Republicans that are ready to vote for comprehensive immigration reform. There are 180. Mr. Speaker, give us a vote. So the reality starts to say it's time for Congress to act. It's time for the Congress and for the Republican majority to give us a vote. Look, I don't ask them to vote for comprehensive immigration reform if they don't want to. The fact is that there are people like Paul Ryan, there are people like Balladale, there are Republicans across this nation who have spoken up for comprehensive immigration reform. Now they have a rule. Here's the Republican rule. They say that it's the Hastert rule, that before the Republicans can bring up anything in the House of Representatives, that first a majority of the majority must be in agreement, which means 118 Republicans must first agree to something before 435 of us can vote. That's not democracy. That's not democracy. There are 435 members of Congress. A majority is 218. We should allow partisanship to be set aside and allow America's best interest to be set forward. Let it be a majority of 218. I don't want to skimp at 200 or 215. I say 218. You know what you're going to get? You're going to get 235 to 240 members, and we can go to conference, and we can stop this division and this devastating effect that it has. There are 5 million American citizen children whose parents are undocumented and at risk of being deported. It's time to end that.
We are talking with Luis Gutierrez. He is the author of Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. He is an 11-term congressman from Chicago, and he's going to be coming to Madison for a Wisconsin Book Festival event tomorrow night at the Monona Terrace at 7 p.m. You can talk to him now at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, happy to be talking with Luis Gutierrez, a 11-term Democratic congressman from Illinois' 4th District in Chicago. He is the author of Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. And we are talking about that journey. We are talking about issues that are very important to him, like comprehensive immigration reform. He has been referred to as the Martin Luther King of Latinos. He was a key player in the passage of the DREAM Act. And we are welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And if you want more information on his book and his speaking event in Madison, you can go to the Joy Kerr-Dean Show Facebook page or WPR.org, our website. So, Congressman Gutierrez, you open the book talking about this this firebombing. Tell us what happened and why that story is so significant.
Well, look, it was October 1984. I was campaigning at that time for Mondale in 1984. I was speaking out because I had become involved, as I shared with you earlier. I left my Mork and Mindy mode in the spring of 1983. So in 1984, I decided I was going to run against Dan Rostenkowski. Now, Dan Rostenkowski was obviously the most powerful Democrat in the state of Illinois and one of the most powerful Democrats in the United States of America. He was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and a confidant of presidents, of mayors and governors. And I decided that since he could not support the Democratic nominee, Harold Washington, and decided that he was going to support a white Republican, that it was time to challenge him, that the Democratic Party could do better. Well, I got a whopping 24% of the vote in March of 1984. I went to go work for the administration of Harold Washington soon thereafter in the mayor's office. And I went to go work for Harold Washington, and I continued to take on the machine in Chicago. Not only had I taken it on in terms of Dan Rostenkowski and getting my rear end whooped, but I continued to do it at work and reforming and making sure that there were more opportunities in the city. That challenges a lot of people. In 1980, in October of 84, 6 months after I ran for, I went that night. It was one of those Indian summer nights, and so the heat wasn't on. And I remember going and leaving a friend's house for, we had some dinner on that Saturday night, and I picked up the Chicago Tribune. Chicago Tribune was a big, fat newspaper with many different sections, and you could get the early edition at 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, and I bought it. And I fell asleep on my living room window, only to be awoken to a brick coming through my window and a ring of fire in my living room. A jug of gasoline, we would find out, a very crude Molotov cocktail, and rushing up the stairs to get my daughter out of bed and make sure that my wife got up, and fleeing the house and watching the house that we loved so much, our first home, you know, the one that we had sanded the floors down, the one where I had to go to the emergency room because I stepped on a nail, on a dirty, rusty nail, rehabbing it, the ones that we had cleaned, and it really polished and made our little home. We used to watch this old house and then try to figure out how we made our old house a little bit better. And I still remember the challenge of that fire. And how it was, the police really didn't help. If they did anything, it was that. So we tell that story. But we tell the story in the context of, here's where I was in my life. And so I think when people see today a member of Congress, as I shared with you earlier, I think they should see that politics can take those kinds of turns, and that you have to be ready to confront violence at certain times in your life in order to succeed in American politics. That Chicago is a rough place, and that I've come to the Congress of the United States well prepared to take on the challenges here.
When you first got started in local politics, did your friends and neighbors perceive you differently, that you weren't one of them anymore?
Yes. You know, I relate in the book. There's a chapter about the orange neon signs. It's always interesting. So I challenged Dan Rostenkowski, and the first thing you'd believe is you'd say, well, you know, fix the gutters on my house. I planted the azaleas, right? I fixed the windows. I always sweep out in front. We don't, you know, my children are the best behaved and best dressed on the block. And now I'm going to run for public office. And, you know, when your car didn't start, I was there with the jumper cables. I was a good neighbor. I was a good friend. And when I ran against Dan Rostenkowski, I woke up one day to find all of my neighbors had Dan Rostenkowski signs on their windows.
Oh, no.
And so I relate the sense of desperation and humiliation of having been rejected by my very own neighbors during that first election, and how difficult that was. So it's difficult. Chicago machine politics is very difficult. And I described to people why it was that all of my neighbors would do such a thing, why it was that many of them felt it was in their self-interest in order to keep the tree trimming coming, the parking tickets from disappearing, and a bunch of other things that make up Chicago machine politics. I describe those things, and I invite you to look into that world. Mm-hmm.
Well, how tough was it for you to make it in and around Chicago politics while remaining true to your personal convictions?
Well, in Chicago, it was, remember, I get elected in one of the strangest elections. I win by 21 votes, but then they find, several weeks later, enough votes to make it a tie. And so I have to run over again because they declared the March 15th election of 1986. They say, well, that's a tie, Luis. Each of you have got the same number of votes. So I relate that experience of the rough and tumble of Chicago politics. But it was so much fun being with Harold Washington. He was just bigger than life, a reformer who wanted to make sure that we distributed the city services, that we distributed the priorities of infrastructure, of housing, and combating crime and education, that there was equity in terms of that he was going to dismantle the preferences of one neighborhood over another, of one political area having more power than another and therefore influencing just how the budget. So that's how I begin. I then relate how I joined Richard Daley when he ran in 1989, and I relate the experience of his brother, Bill Daley, who went on to become Commerce Secretary and Chief of Staff to President Barack Obama. I relate those stories, and I invite you to come in and see what it's like to make a transition to Richard Daley administration and how I get to the Congress of the United States. So we do relate the Congress of the United States. I think, to be quite honest with you, the one thing that has centered me is my commitment. When I got to Congress very early on, I think it's very, very important that we understand that this place is a Congress, you know, it has like a set of rules and behaviors and expectations unlike anything else in America. It's one of the most exclusive clubs in America. There's only 535 of us. And until you've been one of them, it's impossible to really know what goes on. So And Still Dreaming is like my best shot at giving Americans, you know, a kind of visitor pass into the club. I think it's I'm a, like your tour guide, right? Because I've been here for 20 years to let you know what it's like. But what's kept me grounded is traveling. I travel a lot around this country, championing the cause and rallying the immigrant community and challenging my colleagues in Congress to come and to understand. I do a lot of these events because I share my experience of doing an event with Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco. And as she turned around and said, you know, it is un-American. And so I have rallies and rally the community so that their faces and stories can be heard by other members of Congress, and thereby turning them into champions and advocates. I also write in the book about my own cardinal, the Catholic Church in Chicago, and how once I was uninvited to my own Catholic Church because of my position on women's right to choice and their control over their reproductive body. And so I write about that and the challenge and how it was we came together and united the forces. But what was very important as I organized that rally ultimately with the Cardinal is that he said it was immoral to continue. I mean, when you take the titular head of the Catholic Church from the city of Chicago and he says Barack Obama's immigration and deportation are immoral, it brings new power to your cause. And so what I've tried to do is unite and bring our immigrant community together. So when they say, well, Luis, what have you accomplished? 50,000 new citizens in the city of Chicago. I want the city of Chicago and I want our immigrant community not only to grow in numbers, but to grow in power and to grow in influence and to integrate themselves more fully into the fabric. That is the immigrant community. And it's in stark contrast with the arguments that many of the anti-immigrants make today that somehow we're just this rogue group that are here in this country trying to be on welfare and as some have even said, bringing disease and disaster to our nation.
You know, these events on Saturday, besides calling for the Yes. Comprehensive immigration reform. You want President Obama to use his executive authority to end deportations?
So as we began 6-7 weeks ago, as we began to say, well, you cannot demobilize people. I think a mistake that Barack Obama made and was like he mobilized the nation, right? He mobilized me. We elected him president of the United States. I still remember, I don't remember, was it 1.5 million, 2 million people? It was crazy here in Washington, D.C., but during his inauguration. It was just crazy insane in Washington, D.C. And then he kind of said, okay, thanks a lot. I can take it on from here, right? No, I think you have to keep, nothing happens in Washington, D.C. without a persistent and consistent demand outside of Washington, D.C. So that's what we're doing. I believe that the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the rights for workers' rights in this country, the LGBT community and their rights, they've always been generated and sustained because people outside of Washington, D.C. never let Washington, D.C. forget that that they needed to happen and that that demand existed. So that's what we're doing. But we're going to come back to Washington, D.C. across the nation on the 8th. And there are going to be there will be tens of thousands. I want my colleagues to know the following, that all I want the Congress of the United States is to allow a Valadao, a Republican from California, to join a Jan Schakowsky from Chicago, a Gutierrez from Illinois to join Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, to let Republicans and Democrats do the people's work, free us from our this club mentality. This you have to stay with the herd mentality. Allow for once the Congress of the United States not to have a vocation to their party, but a vocation to people's rights and to a greater sense of fairness and justice in this country when it comes to our immigrants. So that's what our rallies. And listen, we'll come the 8th, and if it doesn't happen, we'll be back in a month. But we are going to be consistent and persistent until we get this done.
Well, Congressman, we have just a minute to go. Nowadays, when a politician writes a memoir, many people see it as a sign that they're aiming for higher office. Is that true for you?
I here's my promise, and everybody put your recorder on. I want to come back to the Congress of the United States. I want to get comprehensive immigration reform. I want to come back to the Congress to see the rules and the regulations made up. And then I want to go back out in the field and continue to work with my immigrant community and let that be my life's legacy. The Congress of the United States is where I began, and it's where I will end my political career.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, and I hope you enjoy your event at the Monona Terrace in Madison. Luis Gutierrez is a 11-term Democratic congressman from Chicago, author of Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. He'll be speaking at the Monona Terrace in Madison tomorrow night at 7 p.m. as part of the Wisconsin Book Festival. More information on WPR.org and on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to producer-director Cynthia Schuster and on-air producer Christy Taylor. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.